This is station PCJ.
This is the son of PCJ. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Hello, friends. It's nice to have you with us once again. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be joined by Keith Somerville, who worked for BBC Monitoring and the BBC World Service, and is one of the people behind SOS BBC World Service, a Facebook page that was created to help fight against cuts made to the World Service by the Foreign Office.
How many of you know the name Derek Partridge? Well, Derek is an actor who's been in such TV shows as the original Star Trek, Murder, She Wrote, and others. He's also a TV presenter. And even more interesting, he worked at Rhodesian Television and the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation. He'll join us to talk about what it was like working in Rhodesia, today's Zimbabwe.
And what is it like working as a foreign correspondent in China? Stephen McDonald from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation will be here with an audio diary.
Also, stay tuned for the details on the PCJ Summer Contest. Media Network Plus, radio that may cause some brainwave interference.
First, let's take a look at some of the news from the world of radio. Paulette?
The website of the Libyan Youth Movement contains a video of NATO's broadcast to Libyan forces in English and Arabic being received on a car radio. This particular broadcast was received in Zintan, a city in northwest Libya, about 160 kilometers southwest of Tripoli. The frequency displayed on the radio is 143 megahertz. There are a couple of comments from website visitors about the Arabic accent. One says, "They are speaking classic Arabic, not dialect. The accent is more likely North African, maybe Algerian or Moroccan." Transmissions are also taking place on shortwave. The same website reports, "This message was picked up with the ICOM R8500 communications receiver with a long wire antenna and balun on the 22nd of May 2011 at 10:30 UTC by Frequency Monitor Center the Netherlands, or FMCNL. It's coming from U.S. Air Force Steel 74 Airborne with a message for Libyan Navy sailors. FMCNL adds that Steel 74 has finally switched to this Libyan GMMRA frequency, 10404.0 kHz, to spread the UN Resolution 1973 message to the Gaddafi forces in Libya. Rebels fighting to overthrow Libya's Muammar Gaddafi have launched a television channel to promote their cause, but part of their broadcast is blocked by a regional satellite, a rebel media official said on Thursday. Libya Al-Arar TV, or Libya for the Free, was created in March to offer an alternative to state-controlled Libyan television, said Mahmoud Shamam, who is in charge of media and information affairs at the Rebel Transitional National Council. "Our goal is to reach the largest number possible of people inside and outside Libya in order to counter Gaddafi's channels, which are engaged in psychological and media warfare against the rebels," Mr. Shamam said, on the sidelines of a media conference in the United Arab Emirates. He said the Qatar-based channel is now broadcasting through satellites, including Hotbird, operated by Eutelsat Communications and the Arab League's ArabSat. But Egyptian-owned satellite company Nilesat has prevented them from broadcasting, he said. The company could not be immediately reached for comment. "We had paid the full fees, but when we inquired, the company said the decision to suspend the broadcast was a political one. The phone calls and emails we received from fans prove that we have decent viewership inside Libya, but that could be expanded if we have access to Nilesat satellite," Mr. Shamam said. Earlier this year, Nilesat also jammed the signal of the Qatar-based satellite channel Al Jazeera during mass protests that toppled former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Mr. Shamam said that the channel was based in Doha, but had no connection to the Al Jazeera network, which is also based there. "The channel's infrastructure is Qatari, otherwise we depend on our own capabilities," he said. Paul Goebel, director of the State Department's Foreign Service Institute, believes the U.S. has erred in cutting shortwave broadcasts to countries such as Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Mr. Goebel was speaking at a discussion of the likelihood that the so-called Arab Spring of democracy movements in the Middle East and North Africa might spread to the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union. In response to a question from Representative Steve Cohen about the influence of radio programming beamed into the countries by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Mr. Goebel said the U.S. made a mistake, abandoning shortwave broadcasts in favor of FM stations licensed by repressive regimes in Central Asia. He said the stations practice self-censorship in order to retain their licenses, defeating their purpose. A leaked government document reveals that the UK's digital switchover for radio will be delayed by another 2 years, according to the Daily Mail. The paper says the aspirational target date of 2015 has been abandoned, according to the Department for Culture, Media and Sport memo. The document, understood to have been written by civil servant John Mottram, says that the radio industry is unlikely to be able to meet the infrastructure costs linked to building transmitters before 2017. It also says that the loss of analog services to digital would probably have to be phased in by region rather than on a single day. This means the process is likely to take 3 years to complete, not ending until 2020. And finally, how many of you know the name Lord Haha?
Hello, North America. This is Germany calling. And that is the end of the German popular concert. And we're now going to broadcast News in English. Our fourth news bulletin of the day. We are operating over five stations in the 25, 28th of May. That was 8:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are operating over five stations in the 25, 31, 41, and 49-meter band.
The man with a cut-glass English accent broadcast to the UK and North America every evening from Nazi Germany. 6 million Britons tuned in to his sneering tones, some entertained, many frightened, others simply intrigued by the latest installment of Germany Calling from Nazi propagandist William Joyce, alias Lord Haha. Joyce was hanged for high treason when the war ended, but now 82-year-old Heather Iandolo, his daughter, is making an appeal to the British authorities to have her father's guilty verdict overturned. Aged just 17 at his death, she's just put her name to an application to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which asserts that not only was her father not technically British and therefore unable to be a traitor, but he was also a double agent for MI5 throughout the war, a protege of the spymaster who inspired Ian Fleming to create the Bond character, M. Special thanks goes to Andy Sennett at Radio Netherlands Worldwide for the stories used. If you'd like to find out more developments, you can check out http://blogs.rnw.nl/media network, or just go to www.pcjmedia.com and you'll find a link there.
This is Media Network Plus.
Well, May 21st came and went. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the claims made by a U.S. preacher by the name of Harold Camping, who claimed that the world would end May 21st. Well, that didn't happen. I have to say, on the day itself, I took my dogs for one final walk, had one really good meal. There was 15 minutes to go, so I said, well, let me watch a little bit of television to kill the 15 minutes of time, and then came across an episode of Gilligan's Island instead and forgot about everything else. It was a good episode, by the way. It's the episode where Ginger thinks she's a fortune teller. Anyway, this is the third time that Mr. Camping is wrong. Now, do you think that he is going to admit to it? No! Instead, just before recording this program, this is what he had to say at a press conference.
On May 21, 2011, we didn't feel any difference. We didn't see any difference in the world. But we know from the Bible that God brought Judgment Day to bear on the whole world. The whole world is under Judgment Day. And this is it. And it will continue right up until October 21, 2011, and at that time the whole world will be destroyed.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. That's where it starts with an earthquake. Birds, snakes, and aeroplanes. Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
eye of a hurricane. Listen to yourself, turn worlds into its own needs. Stubby, save your own needs. Speed it up on that speed, got no speed. The ladder starts to clatter with the fear of fight down. High flyer in a fire, represent the southern gang from the government for hire in a combat site. Listen, what's coming in a hurry with the fury breathing down your neck. Team reporters, grab a trunk, get the ground, look at that low plane, find that uh-oh, overflow, population corner, blue, but it'll lose, save yourself, save yourself, a world, save your own need, listen to your heartbeat, tell me that the reds are in the reds are in the right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam fight, right, I'm feeling pretty psyched,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, I feel fine.
Many of you, including myself, who've been listening to international broadcasting for a long time, have certain memories of what we first heard. It could be a show like DX Jukebox with Harry van Gelder that was on Radio Netherlands, or an announcer like Joe Adamov, who for over 50 years hosted Moscow Mailbag on Radio Moscow and then the Voice of Russia World Service. There were also jingles and interval signals that were played before each program that many people today have fond memories of. Now, let's see how many of these you know or have heard.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
Radio Canada International.
Radio Canada International.
Well, those were the intervals and jingles for the Voice of America, Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System, as it was once known, what a title, Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Canada International. One of the first jingles I heard on shortwave was as a boy of 7. It is something I will never forget, and it made me a loyal listener to the station ever since. Now, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but we'll take a listen to this, and I think you'll guess. Yes, the BBC World Service jingle that was played on the hour, every hour. Well, this got me hooked. Now, I just didn't tune to the BBC for news. I also tuned in to the John Peel Show, the UK Top 20, the Tony Myatt Show, drama, comedies, the prom concerts. Yes, I was very hooked. At that point, from the age of 7, a day has not gone by that I have not listened to the BBC World Service.
Now, those of you who've been listening to the program on a regular basis know that we have been giving great attention to the cuts to the BBC World Service. Many thousands of people around the world are also mystified and angry at the cuts to shortwave services to regions of the world where press freedom and access to information is controlled, like China, for example. There have been many tweets and blogs posting the latest information. One of the best is the SOS BBC World Service group on Facebook. SOS BBC World Service is made up of people from the four corners of the world, including a number of current and former BBC World Service employees who have intimate knowledge of the work done by the BBC World Service. One of those involved in the Facebook group is Keith Somerville. Keith began his work at the BBC in 1980, working at BBC Monitoring. He then ended up at Bush House as an editor and producer for various programs.
After I'd been out and worked in Malawi, the BBC, because I didn't broadcast, the BBC allowed me to write on a freelance basis for specialist African publications. And because very few foreign journalists have been able to get into Malawi, the fact that I'd lived there for 9 months and knew a lot of the people there, I started writing quite a lot about Malawi. I also wrote, because of my background with the Soviet Union and Southern Africa, a lot about the Southern African liberation movements. And I also worked for the anti-apartheid movement. And as I was doing this, a lot of writing on Southern Africa, I started being interviewed on a regular basis for World Service programs, particularly on the war in Angola, on the role that the Soviet Union and Cuba were playing in Southern Africa. Then, somebody suggested to me, why don't you come up and actually work for us? Instead of us just interviewing you down the line from Caversham, come up and give it a try for 6 months. Come up and work here temporarily. I went up there and I loved it. I loved getting, as you can tell from the amount I'm talking, I loved getting in front of the microphone. And so I then stayed at the World Service, initially as a producer, then as an editor, then as an editor of a group of programs. And then eventually, much later on, after I'd done about 15 years of broadcasting, I moved into training other journalists.
Now, let me ask you, because one of the challenges that goes on with international broadcasters today, the BBC World Service, Radio Canada International, Voice of America, and many others, is people that are working in that medium quite often don't know what international broadcasting is. They're hired strictly as journalists. Was that the case when you were there? Or did you, I mean, for example, at home, listen to international radio as well?
I listened to the World Service endlessly. I would never have the World Service off my radio when I was at monitoring, when I moved up to work for the World Service. I think because I'd been in monitoring, I then also had the background of what other broadcasters were saying. And we would, of course, at the World Service, get all the transcripts from monitoring of what major radio stations, news agencies around the world were saying. And at the World Service, recruitment was very mixed. It was very, very eclectic. So there would be people like me who came from the monitoring background with specialist areas that we had knowledge on. They would also recruit people from newspapers, from domestic radio, who had the radio or journalism skills, and then they learned about international broadcasting, about their audience, about international affairs. Well, I felt I knew about that, and I learned about radio. So it was a mix, and so you got a really fascinating mix of people there. Massive, massive well of experience, knowledge, and not, I hasten to add, and in fact mainly not the English speakers, but the people recruited from across the world. What made and makes the World Service so strong is this mix that people are recruited from the countries to which they're broadcasting.
Now, one concern that has been brought up, not just in the UK, but in many other countries, usually when there's government cutbacks, the first thing they look at is the international service, because the domestic population don't listen to it. And, for example, in Canada, the reaction from most Canadians, let's say, who don't live or travel outside of Canada is, well, Radio Canada International, we don't need it. Is that the same kind of view that you have in the United Kingdom?
Not exactly. I think there are an awful lot of people in the United Kingdom, and I'll be quite rude here, people who are the Sun readers and who watch soaps and don't listen to the news, don't watch the news, who probably think World Service, well, so what?
Mm-hmm.
But there are an awful lot of people who know of it through having listened to it when abroad, know of it because other people listen to it. And there is, I think, quite a pride in the World Service because it is still viewed around the world, and I think rightly so, as one of the most reliable, least unbalanced, and best informed sources of news. And I think there is quite a pride in a lot of people who know about it throughout Britain, even people who don't listen that often, that here is something that actually represents the best of what British journalism and the best of what Britain viewing itself as a fair country can present to the world.
Well, you know, something else I think that makes the BBC World Service special, I mean, I've traveled a fair amount through Southeast Asia, and when I went to Indonesia last summer, I spent a couple of weeks there, and I went off into villages in the countryside, and there were people that every night would listen to the BBC World Service on shortwave, not to get news from the United Kingdom, but to get news about Indonesia.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, because we recruit people from those countries, we get the knowledge, we get the contacts. When I was working at the World Service, if I wanted to know before doing a broadcast or before putting together an item for a program, say on what was going on in Kenya or Tanzania, I wouldn't just look at the wires. I wouldn't just look at what was in the papers. I would go to our Swahili service, because they would know. And so we would broadcast back to those parts of the world a level of knowledge and coverage and insight into what was going on in their countries based on indigenous journalists, but who were not being, if you like, hemmed in by the restrictions of their own governments. So, say, the Indonesian service would have great journalists from Indonesia who could broadcast from London what they knew without the danger of the pressure from the Indonesian government or political parties about what was being said. Same in Kenya, that the Swahili service or the English service can broadcast back to Kenya in a way that Kenyans have trouble broadcasting themselves because of the pressures on them within Kenya, whether the pressures, as happens, of bribery, threats, or just that they can't get access to the news.
At the beginning of this year, it was announced that the BBC World Service would be facing cuts. And some of the cuts, some people would say, you know, I could sort of understand, but some of the comments made by certain people, for example, Louise Bagshaw, she was interviewed on the BBC World Service about the dropping of shortwave to China. It kind of makes me wonder sometimes who the leaders now are, because she had this view that nobody listens to shortwave and that's it. And from my point of view, that sounded like somebody either that has never been to China or who never lived there. Now, I lived in China for 8 years, and I can tell you that, of course, not in Beijing or Shanghai or Shenzhen or the major cities, but when you go outside those cities, people still do listen to shortwave, and not just to the BBC World Service, but also to domestic stations that use shortwave to reach an audience. When these cuts were announced, was there a lot of surprise within the BBC?
There was certainly a lot of surprise among people I know still within the World Service and journalists within the BBC that they were cutting shortwave for that very reason, that I think there is this view. And it is unfortunate over the years, as the BBC centrally, ever since the mid-90s, where John Burt made a move to really take over control of World Service news, because I think it was felt John Burt was very much a centralist and liked to have control. It was felt that the World Service was down the road at Bush House. It was what was called an island. It was an island broadcaster. True, it was an island in the middle of the road at the Strand and Kingsway there, but it was an island in the sense that it was away from Broadcasting House, away from White City, away from so much centralized control. And I think as this centralized control has been implemented more and more, and the people who have been appointed at the head of the World Service, very good administrators and sometimes in their own right journalists as they are, they do not have the World Service background or the understanding of the audience in detail that people who've worked there have. And so they think, you know, shortwave is something old. It's been overtaken by radio online, by FM, by radio on your phone perhaps. Shortwave's outdated, it's old hat. So I think, well, that's the thing we can get rid of, without actually knowing in detail the fact, as you said, that people in lots of parts of the world, China, for example, and I know very much from Africa, still listening in shortwave. The other thing that I think is very important is that FM is very limited in scope, in range, and has to have transmitters in the area rebroadcasting. That makes it vulnerable to interruption. So, well, a place I know quite well.
We've seen this actually happen quite recently in Africa. There was the BBC Radio France International. They were taken off local transmitters because the local government didn't like what the BBC and Radio France International were saying.
Exactly. It happened last year in Rwanda in the run-up to the elections. Kagame wanted to make sure he was re-elected. He's become more and more authoritarian, less inclined to listen to any form of criticism. In the run-up to the elections, BBC and I believe also RFI FM were cut off. So there was no service if they couldn't get it on shortwave. If shortwave broadcasts are cut out to East Africa in Swahili and in Kinyarwanda, it makes it very vulnerable. FM is vulnerable. Online is vulnerable. Gaddafi and others in the Middle East have tried to block access online to prevent news getting through to the people who are opposing them.
Well, we see this. This is something that China's been doing for years. When I was in China, I was able to access, say, the Radio 1 site, Radio 2, Radio 3, Radio 4. But when I went to click on the BBC Chinese service or the BBC World service, it was blocked.
Exactly. And it is much, much harder to block shortwave. You can try jamming, but it doesn't always work. Somebody who'd been, I think it was James Rogers, who was a BBC correspondent in Moscow for many years, told me that it was very strange. You normally expect people in urban areas to be the best informed. But he said at one stage it was people in rural areas in Moscow, in the Soviet Union, who were better informed about things around the world because they were unable to jam outside broadcasts in shortwave to every area of Russia or the Soviet Union. They could block it to Moscow. They could block it to Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. They could block it to Kiev, now obviously in the independent Ukraine. But they couldn't block it to all the rural areas. So sometimes people in rural areas would get shortwave broadcasts, whether BBC, VOA, RFI, whoever, that people in urban areas couldn't get. So it's harder to block shortwave, which makes it much more valuable, especially in areas of the world where there is political turbulence and attempts by governments or movements to block news.
This is London Calling.
Now, the Foreign Office Committee had hearings into the impact the cuts to shortwave, as well as cuts to the BBC World Service in general, would have on the United Kingdom and on the BBC itself. There were many letters from people around the world showing support that were used in the final report. Were people surprised?
I don't think so, because, again, a lot of people, there is a lot of support in Parliament. A lot of people were very active in getting in touch with their MPs. I put in a written submission to the Foreign Affairs Committee. Many people I know did. And this had an effect, and they listened. And a lot of MPs, when they're not having to make the direct decisions about savings, are aware of the value and aware that, in fact, it's incredibly cheap. And what they're trying to do is to get the government to ring-fence funding within the Department for International Development, DFID as it is known, to ring-fence that to stop the cuts in the World Service. Whereas, of course, what the BBC did, the executives at the BBC and the World Service, Peter Horrocks, Mark Thompson, overall in the BBC, they just acted like willing sacrificial lambs. They, in fact, were offering up more language services to be cut than the Foreign Office wanted cut. And so they jumped ahead too far. They were too keen, I think, to please the new government, which is often the case in the BBC, particularly after the whole Gilligan and David Kelly affair, the WMD in Iraq. The BBC, I feel, almost is willing to self-censor itself or jump in and try and be so helpful to the government so it doesn't come under the criticism it used to come under. And this means that they cut some of the most valuable things. Kofi Annan described the World Service as Britain's best gift to the world, most important gift to the world in the 20th century. It remains that. But if you start cutting it away, not just salami slicing, but massive amputations, you lose that value.
A few months ago, just after the cuts were made, I did contact some people at the Foreign Office to get just to find out some information. One of the questions I had was, have you ever listened to shortwave when traveling outside the UK? Now, here in Taiwan, which Taiwan is a very wired place, I mean, we have the highest speed internet. A lot of people that I know that listen to the BBC either listen to it from medium wave relays from Singapore or listen to it on shortwave. Shortwave can actually sound really good when it's engineered right. But it seems as one of my colleagues said to me, who lives in Sri Lanka, he said, at one time, the BBC World Service had 10 channels, 10 frequencies in English to Sri Lanka. They cut it down to 3 because of budget. And then all of a sudden, they turned around and said, oh, we're going to get rid of it completely because nobody's listening. Well, hello.
Yeah. I know. I don't know where they get this idea that nobody is listening on shortwave. I think it's because they tend to concentrate their surveys in cities and among the very well-educated who are more likely to listen on FM or to listen online. And they forget that they do still have large audiences beyond the very rich and beyond the cities. And I think there is this prejudice against an old technology. Yes, shortwave is very old. Sometimes you listen and it sounds as if somebody's frying chips in the background, but you can hear it and it is harder to jam and it gets through.
Somebody once said to me, they said, if shortwave had been invented recently and not 100 years ago, everybody would be jumping on it.
Absolutely. I thoroughly agree with that because it gets to places. It's like that... I think there's a beer advert that says it's either Heineken or Carlsberg is the beer that gets to places that other beers can't reach. Shortwave gets to places that other radios can't reach.
Now, there is a Facebook page called BBC SOS Save the World Service. How did this come about? Because it seems to have grown from a very small group of people into a very large group of people. And everything that everybody's been working together to send letters, to lobby the Foreign Office, it seems to be working.
I think it is. I mean, Facebook can be a bit like a snowball. But, I mean, SOS World Service really sort of established through the activism of lots of people who used to work there and who still work there, coming together, exchanging messages and thinking, we have got to do something. And some people, like one of my former colleagues, Zina Rohan, who is very, very active and has been, you know, very dynamic in driving things forward, have helped drive it, have helped publicize it, you know, send things out through Facebook. And a lot of people who listen to the World Service will see that on Facebook and sign up and sign petitions and send their own comments in. So it has really gained pace and it is keeping the momentum going.
It must be something very special when you get people around the world, people that you've never met or people from countries you've never heard of before, little islands somewhere in the Pacific, writing in saying, we support your cause, what can we do?
It is. I mean, it's the nature of the World Service. When I was broadcasting a lot, I'd probably do one trip a year to make programs, particularly documentaries in Southern Africa. And anywhere I went, there would be people, even out in tiny little villages, who would listen to the World Service and listen constantly. And it was part of their life and it was very important. It was their source of information, but also their source of entertainment. And they grew very, very attached to it. I mean, on one occasion, I was in Ghana in Accra and I was interviewing a senior official of the then military government of Jerry Rawlings. And we got to about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and he said, can we just stop the interview for a moment or two, in fact, for about half an hour? And can we go into this room here? Switched on the radio, and there was one of my colleagues from the World Service in the really top program for Africa, Focus on Africa, broadcasting. And this official in a military government set aside time for him and his staff every afternoon to listen to Focus on Africa because it was so important to them. And, you know, I was there, I was part of the BBC, and they loved it. They could then put questions to me, ask them, why did they say that? Why do they approach it like, why do you do it like this? They loved hearing it, they loved criticizing it, but they loved listening to it.
What is the next stage now for the campaign?
I think the campaign just has to keep going, has to keep up a momentum. The Foreign Affairs Committee report was very important, but so far there has been no decision by the government either to say to the BBC, you must reinstate these services and we will pay for it, or to say, no, that's it, we're sticking with those cuts. I think at the moment there have been a lot of other things, the deficit, the vote on AV, the local elections that have then overshadowed it. The key thing is to keep this campaign going so it is not forgotten. Because once services are broken up too much and too much time has elapsed, people will start listening to other things, not because they think they're better, but simply because the world service isn't there. So the momentum needs to be kept going.
Well, you know, this is something actually that has been happening. The Voice of America, BBC World Service have actually had a fair amount of cuts, as well as other international broadcasters. But yet, at the same time, you're seeing China Radio International expand on their shortwave broadcasts.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one thing that's very interesting with China is, as it has become more prosperous, has mixed this centrally controlled economy and political system with very, very vibrant forms of state-controlled capitalism, they have seen the absolute value of the media, of providing entertainment, but also of still controlling the news. One thing I see as a university lecturer teaching journalism is we are getting more and more students from China applying and coming to Britain, and I'm sure going to the States and Canada and other parts of the world to learn about journalism, taking what they learn back to China and, if you like, folding it into the system there, but obviously broadcasting in China within very strict parameters.
Keith Somerville, thank you very much for joining us.
That's great. It's a pleasure.
This is the BBC in Beijing.
Kampala. Reykjavik.
Delhi.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
And I was speaking there with Keith Somerville of the SOS BBC World Service Facebook group. If you'd like to join the group, we'll have a link for them at the Media Network Plus page at www.pcjmedia.com.
Starting June 1st, we'll be having a contest that will run throughout the summer. Details will air weekly all summer on several PCJ programs, being The Happy Station Show and Jazz for the Asking with host Keith Perron, Switzerland in Sound with host Bob Zanotti, Nash Holos with myself, and of course here on Media Network Plus. So Keith, what are we giving away?
Well, we have four absolutely fantastic prizes. In June, July, and August, we're going to be giving away to one lucky winner every month a brand new Texan 920 portable shortwave receiver. This is the kind of receiver that you take on vacation or if you go camping. And of course, everybody that enters will be entered into the grand draw that we'll announce in September. The grand draw prize is a brand new Sanjen ATS 909X, the radio that we talked about on last month's edition. And it's very easy to enter. All you have to do is when you hear this little jingle, PCJ Radio would like to make you a winner. PCJ Radio is giving away three Texan 920 World Band receivers to three lucky winners in June, July, and August. In September, we are having a grand giveaway of a brand new Sanjen ATS 909X worth $399 to one lucky winner. To enter, let us know how you heard this program with the date and time, and answer the following very simple question. What does radio mean to you? You can send your entries to ats909x at gmail.com. Again, that's ats909x at gmail.com. If you wish to enter by snail mail and receive a small thank you gift for entering, you can find our postal address at www.pcjmedia.com. Winners will be announced on a monthly basis on Media Network Plus. So, good luck! That's right, there's the jingle. If you hear that in any of the PCJ shows, just send us an email when you heard the show, where you heard the show, if it was online or whatever, and send us an email to ats909x at gmail.com. That's ats909x at gmail.com. I should mention that if you enter via snail mail, you will also receive a small thank you gift for entering. A question that we actually had not too long ago from someone is, well, if I win the Texan radio, do I still qualify to win the ATS radio? Yes, you do. So enter today. You can find all the details at our website that we'll give later on in the show.
Something that many people wonder is what it's like working as a foreign correspondent in a region of the world where press freedom is lacking. One country where many stories of foreign journalists being harassed and followed is China. Since the end of the 2008 Games, when the world thought China was opening up, after the Games ended, restrictions on foreign journalists tightened, including on who you can interview and what story you can report on. Stephen McDonnell is the Beijing correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He now gives us a diary of what it's like.
Well, I've been wanting to do a story about Christians and Christianity in China for some time. We soon found trying to speak to these people, these underground churchgoers, in the current climate in China is really difficult because the authorities don't want you to speak to them and they're monitoring them. And if you try and speak to them, well, as we found out, that we would then be the target of the authorities, of secret police and what have you. Any story in China can become potentially really difficult, and sometimes it can become surprisingly easy. In the case of this story, I didn't expect it would be anywhere near as hard as this. It's pretty hard to go and meet up with people and talk about sensitive subjects when everything you do is being watched. Everywhere you go, you're being tailed. When we were in Zhejiang province, we were being followed by, obviously, it was secret police, because everywhere we went, they would follow us. So, of course, we decide we've got to try and include this in the story. You know, if we're down there, we can't speak to the Christians we're going to talk to. We might as well just film the goons. Correspondents here are being called into the police regularly and asked to explain their stories now. They're doing this with taped interviews with the police. Police are asking for their sources. How did you find out about this? Can we see your notebooks? There are a few hundred correspondents in Beijing at the moment who are all scratching their heads and wondering whether this just is the new way things are going to be forever or for the immediate future, whether or not this is just a situation that will pass. It's definitely becoming a harder place to report in, there's no doubt about it. I should add, though, that in China, maybe 90% of the population are not coming up against any of this. It's just that certain groups, whether they be Christians or human rights lawyers or academics or anybody who's trying to do something that brings them into a bit of conflict with the authorities, and especially in conflict with the Communist Party, they are really having their rights trampled on at the moment.
And that was Stephen McDonnell, the Beijing correspondent of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Now, how many of you know this?
The time is 2 minutes past seven, and we present Dinner Music.
Well, that was the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation, or RBC. Many things in Rhodesia, or today Zimbabwe, have changed. But the broadcast history in the 1960s and 70s is very interesting. The RBC was working under very difficult conditions after the government of Harold Wilson pushed for international sanctions against the nation. This did not stop the RBC and later RTV, Rhodesian Television, to have sent via South Africa equipment and staff. Today, very little is known on what it was like working and living in Rhodesia at the time. There are many facts that have been distorted, and the only way to get correct information is by speaking to people who were living there.
One of those people is actor and TV presenter Derek Partridge, who in the late 70s hosted Frankly Partridge for Rhodesian Television and hosted music programs at Rhodesian Radio. So if you were in Salisbury, today Harare, and were sitting down after dinner to watch TV, this is what you would have experienced.
Good evening. We're starting off tonight on the martial arts. With me in the studio to tell us something about one specific aspect of them are Patricia Backer and Eric Morris. Good evening and welcome to you both.
Good evening.
Well, although it perhaps wasn't said, I, in essence, became a non-person because we in Rhodesia were subject to United Nations sanctions, and I, in effect, had broken that by going out there to work. No, it never in any way affected me by people saying that, but I know exactly what you're talking about from what happened to you, and that would have been the attitude from Prime Minister Harold Wilson, but it didn't seem to permeate down to many other people. In fact, I would say the majority of the people in England were very pro-Rhodesia. They were not on the side of Harold Wilson. Many, probably the majority of Rhodesians were of British origin. Rhodesians came from, you know, many countries around the world, but the majority certainly would have been of British origin.
When you ended up at the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation, you said the decision took 10 seconds to go down there. And, you know, they're saying, okay, come down here as a TV presenter. This was your something that you've been dreaming about for all this time. What was it like the first day that you showed up for work and said, okay, we have a TV show to do?
Well, first of all, it wasn't the Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation. It was Rhodesian Television. At the time, Rhodesian Broadcasting Corporation was the radio station, and it was state-controlled. RTV, Rhodesian Television, was a private company, very successful, and a completely independent entity from it. Later on, I'll tell you what happened with that. But at the time, no, it was an independent entity. Mike Hart Jones, for my first talk show, gave me two priests who were both very talkative and very controversial because they came from opposite sides of certain religious beliefs. So I didn't have to do one heck of a lot. Yeah, I suppose it was, but it seemed to come very naturally to me. I really didn't have any problems with it. I just got on with the job and did it. Because of the war, we did have a teleprompter, but we didn't have enough personnel to operate it. So for the news, you read scripts which you had previously typed or the news department had typed. And it was rather funny. We were rather formal there, sort of, you know, suit and tie, but because of the heat, we usually had sort of bathing trunks underneath where you couldn't see them. It actually reminds me of the early days of British radio broadcasting when Lord Reith was in charge. And this is for radio, I stress. He insisted that his radio newscasters were tuxedos, dinner jackets, with high pointed wing collars digging into their throats. It's hard to imagine anything more stupid. But no, not really much of a problem. But Frankly Partridge was a live show, so things can go wrong, and you often find yourself sitting in your seat, and you can see the control room, and you can see people panicking madly, and you have to sort of sit there very calmly and try and get through it. One thing about the news, though, you would read your newscasts, and then you would go and listen to the BBC to see what the news really was. You know, there was a certain amount of censorship, I suppose you can call it that, but when you're at war with a terror organization, it's not unreasonable that you have to have some control over what you broadcast to people. It's a very small country, very close-knit, and one of the worst jobs that we had to do every night when we started off the newscast. The first item was, Combined Operations Headquarters regrets to announce the death in action of, and then you would sometimes read your own friends' names. That was tough.
When you were in Rhodesia and doing the TV series, how long did that run for, and what was your deciding factor on leaving?
Everything I did there, the news, the Frankly Partridge, the Quiz Kids, and I did many Message to the Nation specials. I was there for 2 years. Then what happened is that the Minister of Information, who was a great supporter of me, died. And at the same time, somebody in government decided that RBC, the radio, should take over RTV, so that it became, again, a totally government-controlled entity. As a result of that decision, virtually the entire staff of RTV resigned in protest. Some 25 people, all the top producers, directors, technicians, engineers, everybody resigned. They just weren't prepared to work for what we consider to be the idiots at RBC.
Mm-hmm.
This was an incredibly brave decision because it wasn't like in any other country where you've got 10, 20, 30, 50 other TV stations you can go to. We had one television station in Rhodesia. So they were, in fact, cutting off their jobs and their professions. And they had nowhere else to go. I stayed on for a while because, unknown to the people at RBC who had always been very jealous of RTV, I had a contract, so they couldn't get rid of me initially. When the contract came to an end, they were only too happy to get rid of me. At that point, some people decided to get up a petition to keep me in RTV and in Rhodesia. And there were sort of booths set up all around the major cities with people collecting signatures to keep Partridge in Rhodesia. And ultimately, it was as if you compare populations, it was as if about 10 million Americans signed a petition saying we want to keep this guy. And this petition was presented to the head of RBC, a very unpleasant Irishman called Jimmy Neal. It didn't achieve anything, and so eventually I left. I did return to the country after that because Rhodesia as it really is leaflet I did, I revised it and did a new version. So I came back to the country to do that.
Here's the story of Rhodesia, a land both fair and great. On the 11th of November, an independent state. This was much against the wishes of certain governments, whose leaders tried to break us down and make us all repent. But we're all Rhodesians and we'll fight through thick and thin. We'll keep our land a free land, stop the enemy coming in. We'll keep them north of the Zambezi till that river's running dry. And this mighty land will prosper, for Rhodesians never die.
Derek Partridge. You'll be able to catch the full interview with Derek Partridge on an upcoming edition of The Happy Station Show. And well, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus. Before we end, I want to remind you again about the contest that we're having here at PCJ Radio. If you want to have a chance to win one of three Texan radios, the 920, and be entered into the grand draw for an ATS 909X, just send us an email to ats909x@gmail.com. Let us know when you heard the program, or you can send us a snail mail. Our address is PCJ Radio, care of contests, 8th floor, number 47, lane 31, section 1, Sanmin Road, Banqiao, Taipei, Taiwan, ROC 22070. Now, I know I said that a little fast, but you can find all the information at our website, which is, Paulette?
www.pcjmedia.com, or send us an email to pcjmedia@gmail.com.
You know, Paulette, I think that you and I now should prepare for October 21st, don't you?
Absolutely. What's for dinner?
Oh, I have no idea, but I'll make sure that I have some good wine on stock.
Thank you. Cabernet Merlot, please. So on behalf of me, Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada.
And me, Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan.
We hope to see you again very soon. Bye for now.
And best 73s.
I'm feeling pretty psyched. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Oh, 6 o'clock, TV hour, no, we got 4 hours, session, burn, return, listen to yourself, journal, like a mini uniform, a book, a burning bottle, like an every motor, escalating, not a motor, cinderic, not a motor, not a kettle, step down, step down, watch your heel, crush, crush, up all this speed, no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer, clear, tournament, a tournament, a tournament of lies, you offer me solutions, but not from the alternative,
and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end.
end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
I feel fine.